Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Over two grim nights in Los Angeles, the young followers of Charles Manson murdered seven people, including the actress Sharon Tate, then 8 months pregnant. With no mercy and seemingly no motive, the Manson family followed their leader's every order. Their crimes lit a flame of paranoia across the nation, spelling the end of the 60s. Manson became one of history's most infamous criminals, his name forever attached to an era when charlatans mixed with prodigies, free love was as possible as brainwashing, and utopia or dystopia was just an acid trip away. 20 years ago, when journalist Tom O'Neill was reporting a magazine piece about the murders, he worried there was nothing new to say. Then he unearthed shocking evidence of a cover-up behind the official story, including police carelessness, legal misconduct, and potential surveillance by intelligence agents. When a tense interview with Vincent Bulugosi, prosecutor of the Manson family and author of Helter Skelter, turned a friendly source into a nemesis, O'Neill knew he was onto something. But every discovery brought more questions. O'Neill's quest for the truth led him from reclusive celebrities to seasoned spies, from San Francisco's Summer of Love to the shadowy sites of the CIA's mind control experiments. On a trail rife with shady cover-ups and suspicious coincidences, the product of 2 decades of reporting, hundreds of new interviews, and dozens of never-before-seen documents from the LAPD, the FBI, and the CIA, chaos mounts an argument that could be, according to Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Stephen Kay, strong enough to overturn the verdicts on the Manson murders. This is a book that overturns our understanding of a pivotal time in American history. The book that we're featuring this evening is Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, with my special guest journalist and author, Tom O'Neill. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Tom O'Neill.
Thanks. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. This is, as I mentioned, one incredible, incredible investigation you've undertaken, and the result is one fascinating and incredible book. Let's get right into this. In March 21st, 1999, tell us, freelance journalist at that time. Tell us who called you and what they offered as an assignment to you at that time.
It was my old editor from another magazine. She had moved to Premiere, which was a film magazine, and she asked me to do a 30th anniversary piece on the Manson murders, and I wasn't interested in doing it because never been interested in the case. I just assumed that, you know, there was nothing new to write about it. So I was pretty reluctant, but she persuaded me to do it. She knew I needed a job, and I thought I was accepting a 3-month assignment. I didn't know it was going to take quite as long as it did, and I'm pretty sure had I known then what I knew now, I probably would have said no. I still don't know whether it was worth 20 years of my life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You say it turned into an obsession, obviously, and took over your life. That's understandable.
Well, tell us. It wasn't so much that it turned into an obsession, but it was more of a, I wanted to find the answers. Once I figured out things happened differently and that people had covered stuff up and hidden things, I guess you could say it became an obsession to get the truth, sure.
You write that one of the first things you did was to read Helter Skelter from Vincent Bulugosi. Tell us about that, why that was important.
Well, I mean, if I was writing about that case, that was considered, and probably to this day is still considered, the definitive book on the case. And I was reading it for the first time, and it's a page turner. I have to give it that. But now I think pretty differently about the book and look at it a whole lot differently. But at the time I read it, you know, without knowing anything really about the case, I just kind of fell hook, line, and sinker into the narrative he presented and believed everything he told me. And it was a pretty compelling read.
What was your first step after in this investigation? You had, as you write, you had 90 days, 3 months to be able to do this 5,000 words. So that's what you set off to do. So what was, other than reading the Helter Skelter, the official book, as far as you knew, at least you needed to read that, what did you do next after reading that?
Well, like any story, I made up a list of potential interview subjects, and I sent a list to the magazine since they have researchers there, and I said, can you get me phone numbers for, I think I could probably give about 20 people who were actors and rock musicians and maybe a couple writers, people that were at least from the world of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski and the other victims. And then separately on my own, I started trying to find people who were, you know, non-celebrities, but who had become important witnesses in the trial. And at this point, I still didn't suspect that anything untoward had happened in the trial. And I also got a phone number for Vince Bugliosi, had an interview set up with him, and he was one of the first people I interviewed. I went to his home in Pasadena and spent about 6 hours in one day just talking with him, going out to lunch, getting a tour of some of the locations associated with the crimes, and, you know, walking away pretty impressed because he had given me so much time. But as I write in the book, by the end of the interview, I realized, even though he was so generous with his time and with his stories, I realized he wasn't giving me anything at all new. He was just saying the same thing that he'd said in a million other interviews and in the book. So I did what we call the Hail Mary pass at the end of the interview. I asked him if there was anything he could tell me that he'd never shared before, something unknown about the case that might give me a fresh angle on it. And I said, if it's something that you'd rather not be associated with, you could tell me off the record. And I'll say, I got it from an anonymous source. And he thought a little bit, and then he said, turn it off, referring to my tape recorder. And he told me something, which was pretty startling and had definitely never been reported before. And you'll find out in the book what that was, or your readers or listeners will, and why it was important, and also why it eventually did become on the record after my relationship with Bugliosi changed.
You say that you, even in that first interview, you knew you were onto something from his behavior and the way he spoke about this case. When you had reviewed his book itself, what was the next step in terms of you attempting to get records? What records officially? You write about police reports,
well,
but what
so
other
much,
records are you interested in?
Well, it wasn't so much from just reading the book. I mean, there were some things that I was hoping to answer, plot points that he even points out in the book that seemed still to this day unexplainable about the case. It was only after I started interviewing people besides Vince and people who had never talked about the case before, who had been key prosecution witnesses, where they started telling me different stories that were kind of contradictory of the official narrative. And at that point, some of it was so dramatically different than what he presented, not just in his book, but even more importantly, you know, at trial to a jury where people's lives hung in the balance, since there were death sentences associated with these convictions. Once I started hearing that from more than one witness, I had to check what they were saying, because it was 30 years later, and some of them told me that they had told the police the same information, but they had never been asked about it at trial or ever seen it in the public forum and believe these books or articles, and they were wondering why. So at that point, I had to corroborate what they said. So I started making a real hard effort to get police files from the LAPD, sheriff's files from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Company, our division, and also the district attorney's files, Vince's own notes. And that was not easy. It was time-consuming. It took a lot of work to get access. And I guess almost all the access I got was through back doors, you know, not to official people who were in charge of the files, but through people who kind of let me in and said, don't tell anyone I showed you this stuff. So once I started getting that and seeing that what these people had told me was true, then I knew it was something that was bigger than a magazine article and would take much more time than the 3 months that had been given to me. And it took a year to, I kept reporting it for the magazine for a year, and then the editor-in-chief got fired, I think partly because he paid me to report on nothing but this for a year. And the new editor-in-chief wanted me to publish right away, and I wouldn't. So at that point, I got a book agent. That was in 2000, 2001 even, maybe early 2001, where I got a book agent. And he reached an understanding or a deal with the magazine where I would give them some stuff later in exchange for being able to walk away with my story and continue on it. But again, I still didn't think it was going to take me as long as it took me. I thought I'd have a book out in a couple of years, but it takes a long, long time to get even the information I have in the book. There's a lot of stuff you don't see in the book because there wasn't enough space. But the documents and the reports were the most important thing that I was chasing.
You looked at the witnesses that were at trial, and you tried to contact as many people as you possibly could. At what point did you look at some of the and talk to some people that were witnesses and find out that there was potential witnesses that it seemed the police had never interviewed?
I just found that out, you know, again, from talking to people and getting access to records and wondering why this person, you know, hadn't testified at trial or why this person wasn't brought into the case in any official capacity. And then I started figuring out that they would screw up the motive that was prosecuted. And if these people, you know, if their information, their stories came out, it would conflict with what they were presenting to the jury. And, you know, when a prosecutor is trying to show a jury that someone's guilty of something, they only have to put on evidence that supports their argument. But, well, they don't have to put on anything that contradicts it. They do have to share that with the defense if it's something that came through police reports. Pugliosi didn't do that. He withheld it from the defense, and that's a violation of what's called the Brady Law, where anything that's exculpatory or that could help the defense fight their case, that the prosecutor has, they're obligated to share it. And when I took some of that information to the two living defense attorneys, the others that died, they both were shocked and said that had they had that information then, they would have actually defended the Manson family entirely differently than they did. They never even put on a defense. Manson wouldn't allow his attorneys and his fellow defendants' attorneys to put on a defense. But Paul Fitzgerald, who was Patricia Krenwinkel's attorney, and Irving Kinnerick, who was Manson's attorney, both said this would have changed the entire trial if we had had this stuff. And he obviously, you know, broke the law by not sharing it with us.
That's a startling claim that you're making. Now,
right.
How did you get to the point where you found out this information, and what information specifically did you find out that you believe that, or you believe that you proved that Bulugosi held back because of this official narrative?
Well, the particular information, the official information I'm talking about right now is about Terry Melcher, who was a pivotal person for the prosecution case. Terry was the reason that Manson, in the official version, chose the house to target its inhabitants who were allegedly strangers to him for death. Terry Melcher was a record producer of Buffalo Springfield, Paul Revere and the Raiders. He had a deal with Apple to work with the Beatles, and he was Doris Day's son. He was, you know, at one time in the 50s, maybe early 60s, the number one female movie star in the world. So Terry was kind of a golden child, and through Dennis Wilson, he had met Manson. And in the official version, that Terry testified to a trial, and Vince Pugliosi presented to the jury and then wrote about in his book. But Terry had this kind of fleeting interaction with Manson. He had met him three times at most, all long before the murders. The last time he met him was when he went to the Spahn Ranch in May of 1969 to kind of informally audition the family for a possible recording contract. And in the official version, Terry wasn't impressed with them, but politely told Manson that he didn't think, you know, they should be working together, but he had a friend who might want to be doing a documentary about the group that would include recording them. And that was that. Everything ended well and nicely in May of 69. And Melcher never saw him again. But what I found from the district attorney's files and then in the sheriff's files were three or four different accounts by two of the main prosecution witnesses that Vince relied on, Danny DiCarlo, who was a biker, who was an associate of the family, and Paul Watkins, who was kind of a hardcore member, both told the police that, and told Vince Pugliosi, in the case of DiCarlo, that Melcher had been to the ranch to meet with Manson after the murders in early September at the Spahn Ranch. And then a second time out at the Barker and Myers ranches in Death Valley, which is a six-hour trip by car. It's pretty rough when you get into the desert to try to get to where their hideout was. So that showed that Melcher had this post-murders relationship with them. And I admit in the book, I don't know what that means, you know, why that had to be covered up. But it does show that it was very different than what was presented, and Melcher was the linkage to the house. Melcher had lived in the house Sharon was killed in prior to her and left in January of 69, and then Sharon and Roman moved in. And without Terry's involvement in the case and testimony, Manson probably never would have been convicted, because he, given the official narrative, didn't go to the house that night with the killers. He sent them there and with orders to kill everybody who lived in the former home of Terry. So without Terry testifying to that, they probably wouldn't have gotten their conviction of Manson for conspiracy. And Stephen Kay, who was Vince's co-prosecutor in the case, said when I showed him these same documents, he said, I don't know what to think about this entire case anymore, because if Vince lied about this, well, what else did he lie about? So those are the questions that come up early in the book that kind of send me even on a longer wild goose chase trying to get the answers to those questions, and that leads to a lot of other stuff. And as listeners will see if they buy the book, a lot of interesting stuff came up in my investigation, some stuff pretty compelling, other stuff dead ends. And I just present everything I have to the reader, and I want the reader to decide in the end what they think happened and why. But I think one thing everyone agrees on after reading the book is these crimes happened much differently than we were told, and for different reasons.
Absolutely. You talk about the official narrative, and your book just opposes that, basically, just examines mm-hmm. it and dispels that. What exactly was the narrative about involving Terry Melcher? Because it was Manson and his followers targeting Terry Melcher, or was it something to do with the house? Why? What was the official story that you had to deal with that Bulugosi put forth involving Terry Melcher?
Well, the official story that Bulugosi told was that Manson knew that Melcher didn't live there anymore, because he had been up there looking for him in March and was told that he had moved out to Malibu. He wasn't told where exactly in Malibu, but also Pugliosi writes in the book and had a couple witnesses testify. Manson told Terry Melcher's good friend Greg Jacobson, another key prosecution witness who was much more involved with the Manson family than Terry was. Manson told him that he had stolen Terry's, or either stolen or moved. There's a couple different versions. Terry's telescope from his Malibu house. He either moved it on the deck to another spot or stolen it. But that was to let Terry know before the murders that Manson knew where he was, where he lived, which wasn't the house anymore. So the official version is they were sent there to instill fear in Terry by killing all the people in his former home. I don't believe that's why they went there. I think the answer lies in what was the real relationship and what was really going on between Terry and some other people in Hollywood and Manson. And unfortunately, you'll see, I can only present hypothetical possibilities because I could never find out. I got like two-thirds of the story without the last third of the answer.
You talk about Dennis Wilson and his involvement in this as well, and that the DiCarlo, one of this incredible witness, says that he witnessed Melcher coming to Manson and the family after the murders and asking for his forgiveness, going down on his knees and asking for forgiveness. Why is this story credible to you, and what does it tell you about the reasons why that the officials would want this not to come out? What would be the possible motivation for this?
Yeah, that was actually Paul Watkins who told a sheriff's deputy that. And I found the sheriff's deputy's report of that interview. And I put exactly what the detective reported that Paul Watkins told him, was that Melcher was at the Spahn Ranch the first week of September, and he fell to his knees. He was high on acid, and he was begging Charlie's forgiveness. The report doesn't say forgiveness for what. It's just, you know, the notes of the interview begging his forgiveness. And Charlie answered, all those pigs had to die. Those pigs had to die. So, you know, as a journalist, you see that, and you're like, the first time I saw it, I thought it had to be wrong. It wasn't until I found out that DiCarlo had told about seeing Melcher at the ranch that same week, actually those same days, and then also reported about seeing him at Death Valley, that I went back to this report. So I couldn't interview Paul Watkins to find out, you know, exactly what he saw and heard, because he was already dead for a long time. Couldn't interview the deputy who took the report because it wasn't signed. I went to Melcher. Melcher denied that it happened, denied that everything I found about him having a post-murders relationship with Manson happened. Bugliosi denied everything, too. So all I could do was, you know, suppose what he might have been asking forgiveness for. But if you see in the book, I never answer what I think that question is, what he was asking forgiveness for, because I don't know. And I'd rather just show what I have that contradicts the official version. And I suggest kind of subtextually, what are some of the things that you know, Melcher might have been obligated to Manson for, that type of thing. He had a much more profound relationship with some of the younger girls in the Manson family. Not only did he ever admit it, you know, he denied on the stand, and in his mother did an authorized autobiography about 10 years after the murders, and she and her author asked Terry to write a chapter about the Manson episode. And in the book, Terry boldly says that he had heard all the rumors about him sleeping with the young women of the group, and he never did, that they were, he called them ugly dogs. And he said he took Michelle Phillips, who he was dating at the time of shortly after the family had been arrested. He said he took Michelle Phillips down to the LAPD headquarters just so they could see that he was going out with like the most beautiful woman and one of the most beautiful women in the world. And he said to them, why would I sleep with these smelly, dirty, flea-ridden women when I have someone like her? But I found out that, yeah, he was involved with Ruth Ann Morehouse, who was about 15, and some of the other ones. So, you know, hopefully someday those answers might be told. I know that Greg Jacobson knows the truth. I talked to him quite a bit for the book, but he was very cagey with me. But there are living people that know the answers to what was really going on. And unfortunately, I can't present a definitive answer to what was really going on, just that it was going on, just that Melcher had this very different relationship and that it was hidden by the prosecution. Ben Melcher.
You talk about the idea of Greg Jacobson and some of these other people that you spoke to that gave you a different picture of what had happened. What about your experience and encounter with Terry Melcher? Considering what you were trying to ask him, what was his response? What was his reaction? What was his behavior like when you spoke to him?
Well, you know, he'd only really talked to one journalist, I think, his entire life. You know, he died in the early 2000s. This was for Rolling Stone. He recorded a solo album, I think, in the mid-70s. So he had to do some press for it. And the only interview I ever found that he did for it was with Rolling Stone. And he was only asked a little bit superficially about this. But he'd never really talked to a reporter before me. The only reason he talked to me was because he heard that I had a lot of this information. And in hindsight, I realized afterwards, he thought he could basically persuade me not to use it by offering me, and it's in the book, and it's on audio tape too, the option to write his memoir. So I had called him a couple times on the phone, and I told him I really needed to sit down with him and show him these documents. And he told Rudy Altobelli, who was another prosecution witness, very good friend of Terry's. He was the owner of the house where the murders happened. He lived in the back house. He wasn't there the night of the murders, but he was a key prosecution witness himself. And he was one of the first sources who was telling me that Terry had lied all these years about his relationship with the Manson family, that they were up there all the time when Terry lived there. And he was kind of like Manson was his guru, I think is how Rudy put it about Terry. And Terry had called Rudy and told Rudy that none of this stuff was ever supposed to come out, and Vince had promised he was going to take care of all that. So when I finally met with Terry, I think it was July 3rd, 2000, on the roof of his penthouse apartment building in Santa Monica, you know, it was pretty wild. He first denied everything and then threatened to throw all of my documents, my briefcase, and the implication was me too, off the roof. He also said he was going to sue me, and he started listing all these attorneys that worked for him. And then he asked me, basically said, why don't you just forget this stupid thing and write my memoirs with me? Because people have been asking me for years. You have no idea how much money I've been offered to tell the stories I have about my mother. And he never called her his mother. He said, the stories I have about Doris and Doris's relationship with Elvis Presley and the Rat Pack. I mean, he was implying that he was going to tell me about his mother. Well, he did. He said she wasn't the girl next door like everyone thought she was. She was still alive. I mean, she only died this past year. She outlived him by many years. And he was her only child, and he was going to set her down the road to get me to not write my book. So that didn't work. But unfortunately, just like Vince, I wanted both Terry and Vince to be alive so that they could answer the questions that they wouldn't answer to me. I was hoping to be mainstream journalists chasing these guys and saying, well, you know, did this writer make all these things up, or tell us the true version? And they would have been stuck in a pretty bad place, because in the book you see all the documents I have and the evidence I have. But that's neither here nor now, or there now, because Vince and Terry both passed away before the book came out.
What was the official motive for this? And you did, of course, in this investigation as well, the connection between Dennis Wilson, the Beach Boys, and this prestigious producer, Terry Melcher. But how serious was Manson about his music career, and how disappointed was he in the process? You also talk about, again, this is the second time I read this, where Dennis Wilson co-writes a song with Manson, then puts it on an album and doesn't credit him for it, takes all credits away from him for that.
Yeah, you know, Bugliosi kept that out of Helter Skelter until he did an anniversary edition of the book where he wrote a new introduction, a new epilogue, and he mentions it in the book that came out 25 years later. I mean, talk about motive for murder. This guy, if he really was like Bugliosi said he was, he only wanted to be a rock star. You find out that not only have the Beach Boys ripped him off and use a song he's written without his permission or knowledge or paying him, but they've also changed the title and some of the words, which could really piss Manson off. I mean, why didn't that come up at trial, and why wasn't that even in the book? You know, that's one of the things that shocked me. And again, it's cherry-picking the facts to support the Helter Skelter Skelter motive, which has Dennis Wilson having nothing to do with this. You also see in my book that Wilson had a longer and extensive involvement with the family than presented to the jury and then repeated in his book. And again, Dennis is dead, and you know Dennis had said, been quoted by several journalists before he died, as saying someday he wanted to tell the truth about the Manson murders and why they happened, but he's gone too.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity for a second to stop for to talk our sponsor, which is Native. At Native, we create safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. We create products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Not convinced? Check out the 8,000 five-star reviews from our customers. Formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc. Filled with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil, antimicrobial, shea butter, moisturizer, and emollient, and tapioca starch, which absorbs wetness. No animal testing, free shipping, and returns. I tried the lavender and rose deodorant. I'm very active, and it's been very hot this summer, and Native has worked fantastic. It's real clean application and smells fantastic. It works. Don't hold back. Native can hang with your workout, busy mom life, or 16-hour day. Test it out, and we have 8,000 five-star reviews. Check us out in Today Show, Women's Health, Elle, Good Morning America, Pop Sugar, Nylon, Hell Giggles, and more. Less is more with Native. We have fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in our deodorant. Aluminum may be linked to some serious health ramifications, although Native is priced at a slight premium when compared to conventional deodorants. It's safe and effective. Native comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women, plus we release new, limited edition, seasonal scents throughout the year. We also offer an unscented formula and baking soda-free formula for those with sensitivities. No risk to try. We offer free returns and exchanges in the U.S. Subscribe and save 17%. Save $2 per stick and have Native conveniently delivered to your door every 1, 2, 3, or 4 months. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during checkout. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during checkout. Now, Tom, we were talking about this official narrative that Bela Lugosi was wedded to and only, as you say, 25 years later mentioned that there was even the participation or the involvement of someone else that might have, again, altered that narrative that he had been with for 25 years. When
right.
When you talk to Greg Jacobson, what was some of the information that he imparted to you that others didn't seem to have?
Well, he would just make a little offhand comment about something that sounds kind of irrelevant when he said it, and then I'd see it in my interview notes and then listen to it on tape after. For instance, that the telescope story, which is so important to tell because that shows that Manson really did know where Melcher lived at the time of the tape murders. I asked him about that, and he goes, oh, yeah, I don't think that ever really happened. That was, you know, kind of a myth. I go, but no, Greg, you testified to trial under oath that it did happen, and you gave details. Now I remember, it wasn't that it was moved, it was that it was stolen. And he goes, ah, well, you know, Vince wanted us to say certain things. So, I mean, there were a lot of little episodes like that in my interviews with Vince, or excuse me, with Greg. But he was, you know, frustrating because, you know, I would go back in the second interview and ask him about that. And he would say, well, I don't understand why this really matters. And I said, what you're basically saying, I lied under oath at the prosecution's direction. That's huge. And he would just kind of laugh. And I think he was a con artist. He's still alive. And I would love other journalists to follow up my reporting and, you know, from mainstream media and ask them about this stuff. But unfortunately, that's not happening as far as I know. Nobody's really picking up the ball and running with the information I put out there.
You talk in the book over the Tex Watson tapes. I had not heard of these. So tell us about the Tex Watson tapes and your battle to try to get to listen to these.
Yeah, well, that's an important aspect, too, because I think a lot of the questions that I wasn't able to answer in the book are answered on those tapes, which is precisely the reason why the LAPD and the district attorney's office, once they got the tapes, you know, with my help and my information, have locked them up and said they're never going to release them. This is the first version of the murders told by a killer on audio tape, and nobody's ever heard it except for Watson's attorney and now the district attorney's office. And I found out about their existence in 2008 and started trying to get them. It's a long, complicated story, but it's in the book. And it ended up when I shared the information with the district attorney's office, they really wanted the tapes. And when they thought I wasn't getting anywhere, they stepped in and actually went to court for the tapes. And it was a year-long court battle in Texas, where the tapes were in the bankruptcy trustee's care of the attorney's estate because the attorney had died and his law firm had gone bankrupt. And she was the one who had them. And once Watson found out that she had agreed to share them, first she agreed to share them with me, and then she panicked because she thought that if there was information about other murders that had never been discovered before, and that's one of the things the attorney said was on those tapes, that maybe she shouldn't give them to a journalist, she should give them to law enforcement. So she asked me for the DA's contact information. And since he had already been talking to me about this, his name was Patrick Security, he was a deputy DA who handled all the Manson parole hearings, I thought, well, I'll loop him in and let him be involved too. So once that happened, they were no longer going to let me have them. And once Secura and his office went to court and fought from the local court, the civil court, to the state Supreme Court for these, and the court finally decided in favor of law enforcement, they got those tapes, and they had promised me I was going to listen to them with them the first time they heard them. Not only didn't that happen, but they never let me hear them, and they haven't let anybody hear them, and I think that's because what's on those tapes is a true account of how the murders happened, why they happened, possibly who else was killed, you know, the true relationship between Melcher, Wilson, other people in Hollywood and the family. And it's 50 years later, and there's still, it's the only piece of evidence that's never been released to our knowledge that the LAPD has. You know, they might have other stuff, but that tape is, I don't think it's ever going to get out.
I know that you don't speculate in this book, but I have to ask you to speculate. What exactly, why was the main reason why Bela Lugosi was so reluctant to take all that information as a prosecutor? Why was his narrative that he put forth in Helter Skelter and at trial so important to him? Why was that theory, that narrative he put forward, why was he so wedded to that in your mind?
Well, I don't really have to speculate about that because I got enough people from the DA's office and from LAPD and the sheriff's office, they all thought that Bugliosi took what was a minor philosophy of the family about a coming race war and embellished it and made it much bigger than it was in order to make the trial more sensational. He was an aspiring writer. He had a contract for a book deal before the trial started. He had his co-authors sitting in the front row of the trial every single day. That's not allowed anymore. I don't know why it was allowed then. You know, you'd be disbarred in the state of California if you had any kind of commercial project of a case, right, that you were fighting for on taxpayers' dollars, and also a death penalty case. You know, he had a conflict of interest the minute he signed that book contract and put his co-author in the front row. The more sensational that trial, the better book he'd have. He was playing to his future readers more than he was to the jury. So that's speculative. I can't prove that that's why he chose that motive, but I can, you know, point you to the two interviews he did, one with Penthouse in, I think, 1975, and one with Rolling Stone in 2015, when he was specifically asked, and these are the only two times I ever saw them, if he thought Manson believed in the Helter Skelter motive. And astonishingly, he said on the record to those two journalists, no, he goes, I'm 100% sure the women and the killers believe, but I don't think Manson for a second believed in that. And unfortunately, the two journalists who did those interviews and were smart enough to ask that question didn't follow up with the natural question, which was, well, then if he sent those people up there to kill, the people at Terry Melcher's home, but not because he wanted to start a race war, well, then why'd he send them? What was the reason? And then the second night, the LaBianca's. And none of those reporters asked them. And my mistake as a journalist is I should have known about the Penthouse interview because I could have asked him myself. That predated my meetings with Pugliosi, but I thought I had read every interview he ever gave, but I missed that one somehow. Didn't see it till after Pugliosi had cut off communications with me. And the Rolling Stone interview was in 2015. I think it was the last interview Pugliosi gave before he died. And the Rolling Stone author, I can't really criticize him too much. He wasn't a crime reporter. He was doing a story for Culture magazine, and I guess it just didn't occur to him to ask that follow-up question.
Mm-hmm. Now, the title of this book is Chaos, and we haven't mentioned what we alluded to and we mentioned in the introduction about the CIA and their involvement. Tell us a little bit about that and why this book is called Chaos, and tell us about a couple of those programs.
Well, the title in the book is kind of a play on words. I mean, chaos can be interpreted either as it was a chaotic period in American history when everything was kind of turned upside down. But there's also, and you don't find this out in the book until the 11th chapter, that the CIA had a secret operation called Chaos that was kind of like the brother operation to the FBI's COINTELPRO operation. And both of those were active in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Got started in San Francisco in 67. COINTELPRO had been something that Hoover originated in the 40s to fight the Ku Klux Klan, and then it became dormant, after the Klan was kind of immobilized and wasn't that active in the 60s, but it was brought to life again to fight the Panthers by Hoover in 67. And not just the Panthers, but other left-wing groups, which is also who Chaos is targeting. And both operations were infiltrating subversive groups. And subversive groups could have been anyone from anti-war protesters to free speech groups to communist, American communist groups to the Panthers, to militant groups. And what they would do is try to get them to commit crimes where they'd notify the local police departments, and then they would arrest them in the process of those crimes being committed and or shoot and kill them. They also tried to provoke them to kill each other. And the COINTEL operation, we know a lot about because a group of activists in the early 70s found out where the files were in Pennsylvania and, broke in, stole the files, shared them with journalists. There were actually congressional hearings, and the FBI had no choice but to admit that they had this secret illegal operation, and they even admitted that they were responsible. I think 18 Panther or Black militant deaths that were the result of the COINTELPRO actions, and they paid reparations. Geronimo Pratt, a famous Black Panther who was in prison for about 20 years for a murder, a double murder he couldn't have committed because the FBI knew he was in San Francisco when the murder happened, and the murder happened in Santa Monica. All that stuff came out. Chaos, on the other hand, nobody's ever found the files. So the CIA admitted they had it because that also came out during these congressional hearings in the mid-70s. But nobody has ever really known the full extent of what they did. And if you try to find a book about chaos, I don't think there is one. I know there wasn't one, at least for the 18 years that I was doing my heavy research on this. I haven't checked the last year or two, but if you can look it up in newspaper articles. But I think my book has the most coverage of chaos of any book that's been published. COINTELPRO, there's been a number of books about it, but it's kind of shocking because their ultimate objectives were to basically stop what was considered then the biggest threat to the national security, which was this left-wing revolution of Black militants, anti-war hippies, all that kind of stuff. And Manson really, really damaged kind of like the whole view of hippies and free love and drugs and rock and roll, all of a sudden they had an evil face for it. And all the parents thought, well, wait, if that happened to these young girls who went out and committed such horrific murders after, you know, using LSD for a year and living communally, which a lot of kids were doing, that could happen to our kids too. And it was really ineffective. Whether or not it was engineered by our own government, I don't come to a conclusion. I just present the evidence I have. Whether or not it was, meth probably did more damage to the hippie movement and the left-wing movement than any other entity during that period.
Absolutely. You talk about your last big break of this book, and you talk about an investigation that seemed to be, as you write, covered it up. Filippo Tenorelli, a 23-year-old.
Yeah.
And the story about suicide. What did you find?
you know, he was a Italian immigrant who had come to the country from Italy in his mid to late teens, I think. He lived in Culver City and seemed to be a pretty well-adjusted guy. All of a sudden disappeared, and his car was found upside down at the bottom of a steep drop-off in Death Valley. And there was blood inside and outside the car. There were spent gun shells. And his body was found in a hotel, I think it was about 120 miles north, in a little town called Bishop, which is on the perimeter of the of Death Valley. And local law enforcement thought that he was killed by the Manson family. The Manson family was arrested, you know, in Death Valley 2 weeks after Tenorelli's body was found. And once they were understood to actually be killers in Los Angeles, local law enforcement, including the DA there, thought that that they had killed this guy, Tenorelli, because the circumstances of the suicide were very suspicious. And one law enforcement officer reported seeing him in the company of two people that he identified from mugshots as Manson family members. Well, local law enforcement, meaning the Bishop Police, were the only ones who didn't think that he was killed by the Manson family. They were sure it was a suicide, and they would not allow the case to be investigated by anybody else, and they had it closed. I came along in 2005, I think, and six, just asking questions about it. And again, it was because once I got access to the DA's files in Inyo County and then some police reports, I saw all this evidence that hadn't been available. Bugliosi never even mentioned the guy in Helter Skelter. But Ed Sanders mentioned him briefly in The Family, that book, and I found him referred to in some of the early news coverage of the Manson family after they'd been identified as Pate LaBianca suspects. And Aaron Stovitz, the co-prosecutor, told Rolling Stone that he thought Tenorelli was a victim of the Manson family. So I brought this massive amount of information to the head of the Bishop Police Department, Kathleen Sheehan, who had just been named the first woman chief of the police there ever, and she announced to the media that based on my information she was going to have the case reopened. So you have to read the whole chapter because it's pretty complicated, but what they did was they reopened it just to get all my information and then immediately closed it without doing any investigation like they had promised. So his family, you know, he had, I think, seven siblings. Five of them were sisters who were still alive. They're all in their 80s. And they're determined to find out what happened, because they never believed he committed suicide. And they're determined to find out what happened to him. And they don't even want, I mean, their main concern, their main priority is just to have his death certificate changed from suicide to unknown cause of death. And that's all they want, because they're very, very strict Catholics, immigrant Catholics. And, you know, you can't be buried in a Catholic graveyard if you committed suicide. And if you believe in Catholicism and the faith, you go to hell. That's the biggest mortal sin after killing someone else is killing yourself. And it's, you know, they've been waiting for years to have this change. And it wasn't until I came to them with actual proof that he more likely was killed than not, that they kind of energized. And one of the Filippo's nephews, Cosimo, has actively hired people, attorneys, investigators and stuff, or he's talking to them, I don't know if he's hired them yet, about suing the state, suing Bishop, trying to get just the cause of death changed. And they're not saying it doesn't have to be changed to murder, although they'd be happy with just unknown causes or unknown cause.
Yeah, certainly. You talked about Prosecutor Stephen Kay, but also that Terry Melcher's attorney approached this DA, again, the co-prosecutor of the Manson case.
Yeah.
What did he ask for from – yeah, so what did he ask for himself and his
Stephen
client? He
asked Stephen Kay to write a letter saying that Melcher's relationship with the Manson family consisted of the three meetings that are in the official book and testified to a trial, once at Dennis Wilson's house and then twice at the Spahn Ranch. And that was before I even began reporting. Stephen Kay told me that in an interview about Melcher sending him this, or Melcher's lawyer asking him to do this, and he said he did it. And I said, why? And he goes, well, that was all I knew until you showed me what you showed me. And I said, you still have a copy of that letter? And unfortunately, he didn't. I couldn't even get the name of the attorney. Couldn't remember. But that had happened, I think, in the 80s or something. I think somebody else was – well, I know this. That somebody else had written a book, Barney Hoskins, about just the rock and roll scene in Southern California. And he has a chapter on the Manson family. And he was forced to, at the threat of a lawsuit, remove a lot of the stuff he'd written about Melcher's relationship with the Manson family. Nothing quite as dramatic as what I found in police reports, but that showed that Melcher was sexually involved with one of the 14-year-old girls who then became 15. He met her when she was 14. And Melcher's lawyers threatened his publisher with a lawsuit, and they burned all the existing copies of his book, and they reissued it with all these modifications. And it's fun. You can I have it in the end notes of my book, the page numbers from the first edition that you can still get because it was available for about a year before the publishers pulled it. And you can compare the pages and see how they were changed at the order of Melcher's attorneys. So Melcher, you know, I wasn't the first one to come to him with this information.
You also include the case of Gary Hinman, again, with Atkins, Bobby Buislow, Mary Brunner, and the torture of this guy over this inheritance. So you give all the gory details of what happens.
Alleged inheritance, yeah. Yeah, it was never been proven that he got the inheritance. And Bugliosi's version, they went over there to steal money from him that they believed he had inherited. He claimed, or he told them he didn't have it. And, you know, there were other beliefs. People believe that Hinman was manufacturing, I think, mescaline and selling it. He had sold a bad bunch to the Straight Satans, who Danny DiCarlo was a member of, through Bobby Beausoleil, and that they wanted their money back, and that's what he was getting tortured and killed for, because they were trying to get the money back that they said he had ripped off. I still don't know what really happened, except that Bobby Beausoleil, Mary Brunner, and Susan Atkins killed him after 3 days of holding him hostage and torturing him.
Yeah, incredible. Let's get to Stephen Kay, the prosecutor, and his conclusions when he looks at the material that you provide for him. And when you alluded to and we mentioned that this would be cause for another trial if it were that strong an evidence to be able to would be able to overturn
right.
or be able to have another trial, I should say. Tell us
yeah.
exactly his reaction to learning this and what he asked of Bugliosi. If he thought this would happen, what else would he think Bugliosi was capable of? Tell us about this exchange, you and him.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had interviewed Stephen frequently in the first year or two of my reporting. But it wasn't until I had all my ducks lined up, you know, all the documents showing how much evidence Bugliosi had withheld, how much perjury he had suborned in witnesses. And I knew Stephen would meet with me because we are on pretty good terms. So it took me till 2005. And I went to see him at his office. And he knew what I was coming for. I said I had this evidence that showed that Bugliosi had completely, you know, invented certain aspects of the prosecution, including, you know, getting key witnesses to perjure themselves. And he told me, he goes, Tom, I know this case as well now as Vince did, because at that point, Stephen Kay had been doing all the parole hearings for all the Manson family members since they became eligible for parole in the mid to late 70s. And he was going to retire like 6 months later. And he said to me that day, he goes, you know, I'm 60-0. That meant 60 times he appeared opposite Manson family members when they had their parole hearings. And at each of those hearings, he had to go through what they were had been convicted of by minute detail, you know, how they killed, why they killed, what was presented at trial. So he did really know the case probably as well or better than Bugliosi. And he said, nothing you can show me is going to convince me of anything other than what I already know. But once he went through the documents, you know, I just saw him sinking deeper and deeper into his chair, you know, holding his head in his hand, shaking his head, and finally saying, I don't know what to think about what I thought I knew so well anymore. And he goes, this is Vince's handwriting. These are his notes telling a very different story. And they crossed out everything that was kept from me and from the rest of the world. It's crossed out by Bugliosi. He says, this is really, really serious. And I said to him, you know, what do I do with that as a journalist? And he said, well, you could take it to the district attorney, the current district attorney, who is Steve Cooley. And I said, then what might he do with this information? And that's when he said, you know, he didn't want to say it, I don't think. He's trying to be straight with me. He said, you know, he could call habeas corpus, which means vacate their convictions and then have, you know, then decide, is it worth putting on a whole new trial against Charlie Manson, Leslie Van Houten, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Bruce Davis, you know, all of them would have to get new trials, or just let them go, you know. And I said, okay, that's all I needed to hear. And I didn't take it to Steve Cooley because I didn't trust what he'd do with it then, but I did think that I was going to have it out within a year as a book, and I knew he'd still be in office, and I thought that's when he can do it. Unfortunately, it took a lot longer than that, and the fact is the book's been out for 2 months right now, and nobody in the media in Los Angeles, nobody at the L.A. Times has asked anybody from the DA's office or the LAPD for a statement on this. Nobody's doing anything about it. I mean, I'll give you a little scoop. The New Yorker's got a big story coming out about the book, about the legal aspects of my findings, where they're all analyzed. And I think it's going to come out either the end of this week or next week. I think that might cause some change. That's what I'm hoping for.
This is, as Stephen Kay said, this would have presented a lot of problems for Vincent Bugliosi, but it still will to his reputation and to the LAPD and other people as well. Is that's in your book in terms of the evidence that a lot of people don't want this unofficial story to come out that you have published, do they?
Well, yeah, you know, the district attorney's office in Los Angeles has been convicted a lot of their best known murder cases. Obviously, OJ is the first one that comes to mind. Robert Blake murder. So for something that seemed as open and shut as the Tate LaBianca murder, you know, committed by this group of so-called hippies who, you know, shaved crosses in their heads, cut crosses in their head during the trial and were thrown out of the courtroom every day. I mean, for them to have to, you know, suck it up and say that trial was run or that those convictions were won on false pretense and on lies and fabrication, they don't want to do that. And I think that's why, the main reason why the most important piece of evidence that they have has never been shared, and that's the Tex Watson audio tapes.
Mm-hmm. The notes that you talk about in this that were crossed out by Vincent Bugliosi were very, very powerful as well, weren't they?
Yeah, that was his first interview with Danny DiCarlo. And Danny DiCarlo was describing seeing Melcher at the Spahn Ranch in September and then out at Death Valley in later September. I don't think when I had the Paul Watkins interview, I did show that to Bugliosi 6 years later in like 2008 or 6 or 7. And again, he said he had never seen it before. But he could say that because I don't believe him because, as he says in his book, he saw every single piece of evidence, every report in the trial. But he told me that day when I showed it to him, he had no idea what it meant. He never saw it. But when I showed him his own notes, he admitted that those are my notes. And yes, I guess Danny DiCarlo told me all of that, but I must have decided he wasn't telling the truth or something later. And I said, well, you were still obligated to share it with the defense. And he didn't have an answer for that or for why he crossed out the DiCarlo interview notes, I think, are like 16 or 17 pages. The only thing that's crossed out and that isn't contained in the testimony DiCarlo did give was that information about Meltzer being at the ranch after the murders twice.
Yes, absolutely. Which offers a lot of support for your idea that once Bulugosi had his official narrative, and of course the book was very, very important to him, and he went on to have a very, very successful career as an author. So you say that his motivations were there and didn't want to upset that apple cart that he had set up.
Yeah, you can tell your listeners, or I can tell your listeners, if they want to see these documents and not buy the book, some of them are reproduced in the book, but a lot more of them are on websites that I've created for the book. One is, I don't even know if you call it a website, one is a Facebook page for the book, which if you just search the book title, you'll get to, and the other one is an Instagram page. It has the same, mostly the same information that, I think it's called Chaos the Book. I can't even remember, but if you put my name and Manson into Instagram, you'll find it. And I've got almost all the documents we've discussed now scanned and presented there. I also have excerpts of audio interviews of me and Stephen Kay, with Stephen Kay making those important statements to me, with Bulugosi and myself. I haven't put up the Terry Meltzer one audio yet, but I'm going to put that up in the next month. And a lot of other things about Chaos, CIA, MK Ultra, that kind of thing.
Wow, it was an incredible investigation that you undertook to do this book, Chaos. Also wanted to just ask, what, again, you're waiting for the reaction from the media in Los Angeles for this book.
Right.
What interview do you have next about this book?
Well, there's two important things that are about to come out. The New Yorker story, which, like I said, is a very long, in-depth analysis of mostly my legal findings, you know, what it means, whether I had enough proof. And, you know, the journalist told me, I'm going to be very happy with it when I see it. He didn't want to tell me too much, but he said he went to some of the leading experts on criminal law, you know, legal scholars about perjury, suborning perjury, what a defense or what a prosecutor is required to share, just to see whether or not my findings held water. And he didn't tell me exactly what they said. He said, you're going to be very happy with the story. So I'm hoping that changes things, because you can't get really a better platform than the New Yorker. With their reputation, people are going to take seriously what they decide, what they conclude. And then there's another online magazine called The Intercept, which is a national security magazine. And they're excerpting our chapter on Jolly West and the CIA and MKUltra. And I've just been working on the edit of that, because they had to condense it. And I'm just making sure everything's accurate. And there's some stuff they had to cut out that needs, you know, a little bit of exposition. And I just gave it all to my collaborator after I finished with it yesterday. And he's going over it now. And then hopefully that'll be out sometime after Labor Day.
That's fantastic. I also wanted to mention for the audience, too, that's going to pick up this book, the incredible photo collection that you have in this book is just remarkable. So I got to commend you on that.
Oh, thank you.
Along with this book, just jam-packed with every bit of information about, I've read all kinds of things about Manson. I've read Helter Skelter and Diane Lake's book. This has got everything and much, much more in this book. I want to thank you very much, Tom O'Neill, for coming on and talking about Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s. As you mentioned, there's a Facebook page for Chaos, and also Instagram. Just type in your name and I'll get around to that information on Instagram posting.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been fantastic. Have a great night. Good night.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.